and welcome to the Urinary Tract System module. This is part one, Anatomy and Physiology. And I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I will be your guide on this module. Before we jump right in and begin, I just want to make sure that you're aware that all the information that I'm presenting in this is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional. It's not intended as medical advice. So if you're listening in on this and getting ideas for your own health, just be sure to consult with your practitioner before putting things into practice. And I advise you before you teach in any way, one-on-one or in classes to your clients, that you make the same disclaimer that if they're on medication or they're under the care of a doctor, that before they put your advice into practice, that they make sure that it's okay with their current care. So let's just look at what the urinary tract module contains. It contains part one, which we're in right now, which is anatomy and physiology. And that's a basic review and probably a little bit more in depth than most have had in the past of the anatomy and physiology of the urinary tract system, all the components, all the subcomponents, etc. In the next part, part two, we'll go into assessment strategies. In part three, we'll look at the pathology, all the things that can go wrong. And then finally, in part four, the part that most people really look forward to is the balancing approaches. My belief in this and all of our modules is that we need to have the basics before we can jump into balancing approaches. We need to understand how the system works and how we can assess what goes wrong and what are all the things that we can be looking for before you jump in and start recommending specific nutrients and herbs and lifestyle factors. So let's take a quick look at the anatomy of the urinary tract system. The urinary system consists of our kidneys, which sits in the back, just a little bit above the waistline. The ureters, which are the tubes that lead down from the kidneys into the bladder. The bladder, which sits just above the pubic bone, and holds urine. And the urethra, which is the tube that leads from the bladder to the exterior so we can void. So let's talk about the functions of the urinary tract system. Well, let's talk about the kidneys first. The kidneys filter the blood, removes all the waste, and produces urine. What does that mean? Well, all the blood that gets through the kidneys was going to contain metabolic waste products, products that have been produced by just day-to-day metabolism, products that have been filtered and played with and made water soluble by the liver for excretion, toxins, etc. So it's a really important function of the kidneys to keep our blood clean. The ureter is just a simple process, right? They just take the urine that the kidneys have worked on and filtered from the blood and just carry it down to the bladder. The bladder stores the urine until it's expelled. Well, that's important because we don't want to be leaking all day long, right? Every time the kidneys filter, we'd be leaking all day long if we didn't have the bladder. The bladder needs to store it, and the bladder holds it until it gets up to its capacity and you get the pressure in the belly that says, ooh, I gotta go pee. The urethra then carries that to the exterior, and we have control of that. We have control of the sphincter that allows the urine to leave the bladder, go into the urethra, and then down and be expelled. And the function of the urinary system, in addition to filtering out toxins out of the bloodstream, is to maintain balance of the electrolytes, the water, the ions, the pH, the blood pressure, calcium, and red blood cells. And there's a lot of interactions we'll go into between hormonal systems and the urinary tract and the kidney and its ability to do its job. So this is a picture, right? So we have these kidneys, like I said, they sit pretty much right above the waistline, and they're in the back. The adrenal glands sit right on top of them, right here. So we have the right and left kidney. Now, we can function with just one kidney. There are people who have a kidney removed and they function okay. There are people who actually donate a kidney to someone who's losing both of the kidneys, because we can't function without both, or we'll just be on dialysis all the time. So with one kidney, somebody can function. Ureters are long, they're skinny, and they lead down to the bladder. The bladder sits right above the pubic bone, and then there's the neck of the bladder, and then down below would be the urethra. So let's talk about the kidney functions in more detail. So it regulates extracellular fluid volume, the fluid that is outside of the cells. It regulates osmolarity. What does that mean? Well, that's the balance of the ions in and out. So sodium and potassium are the two that come to mind as well. It regulates the pH, right? We want to maintain that alkaline pH of the blood between 7.3 and 7.4. And so the kidney is responsible for eliminating those acid residues. So when you measure pH and you measure pH in the kidney, well, you measure pH of the function of the kidney is when you measure pH in the urine. And if someone's doing a cleanse or a detox, we're going to see more acidic waste products being eliminated. If someone's on a toxic diet and lifestyle, we're going to see a decrease in pH and more acidity. If someone's under a lot of stress, we're going to see a higher level of acidity, which means a lower pH in the urine. It also filters the metabolic wastes. So whenever the liver is going to be filtering these toxins that come in, and most of them are fat soluble when they come in, filters them and makes them water soluble for excretion. It's the kidney's job to pull them out and put them into the urine. It also excess ions, so sodium and potassium, so we can measure those things in the urine. We can also measure excess of vitamins and minerals. We know that, say, if we take too many of the water-soluble vitamins, like B vitamins, you'll end up peeing them out. You can measure those in the urine. And then chemicals from blood that are produced by just metabolic wastes, but also chemicals that we may take in, and anything that the body doesn't need is going to be filtered out and excreted by the kidneys. And production of hormones. There are certain hormones that will get produced. We'll look at what some of those are. It's also controlled by hormones, and we're going to look at what some of those hormones are that control it. So details, right? Probably more than you want to know, but I think it's a good idea to at least be exposed to this. So they're bean-shaped organs. They're about the size of a fist. They're located right below the rib cage on each side of the spine. The left kidney is actually slightly higher than the right kidney. Not sure what the reason is for that, but that's the fact. There's a layer of adipose fat tissue that holds them in place and protects them from damage. So if you get a blow to the back, you're not going to hit them directly, although you can damage a kidney with a severe blow to the back. And then each day, this is a huge thing, each day, they filter 120 to 150 quarts of blood to make 1 to 2 quarts of urine. So the average person is going to be excreting 1 to 2 quarts of urine. If they're excreting less than that, they're likely dehydrated and they need to be drinking more. And that's actually a test you can do with people to see if they're drinking enough. Hey, I want you to measure your urine, just big container, and just measure it for 24 hours and let's see how much there is there. And if you're on a cleanse and you're drinking lots of fluids, you may have a little bit more. But if it's more than the 2 quarts on a regular basis, then they're drinking too much and they may be diluting a lot of their key nutrients, hormones, etc. Each kidney is made up of approximately 1 million filtering units. And those filtering units are called the nephrons. And you can see in this picture that, like every other organ and gland, they have a blood supply coming in and leaving. Obviously, for the kidney, it's more important than ever because that's what their job is. So the artery will bring the oxygenated blood in, and then the kidneys filter it to take out the toxins, and they do that through these nephrons and these calluses, and we'll look at the more detail of that anatomy. And then the blood is sent back out through the renal vein, and that renal vein is going to be carrying the blood that has been filtered. So it's pretty cool. And then you can see the ureter, there's this big opening and then drops down into a skinny tube. All right, so we can look at that in a little bit more detail. So let's look at kidney filtration. We've got one is the glomerulus, and those are those little pieces and parts. We have a picture on the next slide to show you that in more detail. The glomerulus is the unit, the filtering unit in the kidney. And like we said, there were like a million of these. And it goes into a tubule called the proximal convoluted tubule. Okay, and that leads down into the descending loop of Henle, and then the ascending loop of Henle, and then the distal tubule, and then the collecting ducts, which reabsorbs water, and then the urine is filtered. Okay, the blood is filtered. So it's just this goes through these little tubules all along. It's pulling out the ascending loop. Okay, we'll talk a little bit about more what each of these do. The proximal convoluted tubule reabsorbs ions, water, nutrients, and removes toxins and adjusts the pH. The distal tubule, this one here, is going to be selectively secreting and absorbing different ions to maintain the pH and electrolytes. So it's reading it. Is the pH okay? Do we have to add back some alkaline minerals here? And it's going to maintain that balance. The ascending loop of Henle will reabsorb sodium and chloride from the filtrate and into the interstitial fluid. The descending loop of Henle is allowing water to pass from the filtrate into the interstitial fluid. So each piece of this tubule system has a different job. And altogether, the end result is that the kidney, the glomeruli, and the kidney filters the blood, gets rid of the stuff we don't need anymore. So let's look a little bit more at the physiology of the kidney. So there's the kidney, there's the filtration, and we have the artery coming in from circulation. We got the vein coming out to circulation. The artery feeds into these glomeruli, and the veins pull the blood back out after it's filtered. All right, so we've got all the blood components enter the kidney, and then proteins, nutrients, water, and some ions are returned back to the blood. So the kidney's going, okay, let's pull this out. Okay, let's add this back. Okay, they need this. We'll add it back. The rest of this, let's get rid of. The kidney's doing its job, and then what's excreted and put back, put into the ureter is the wastes, and then controlled amounts of water, so that we don't become dehydrated, but the right amount to keep the fluid level balanced in the body. And then ions like the excess calcium and sodium and other things like that are excreted. And then back into the circulation goes the filtered blood with everything we need back in there. It's a pretty cool system. And this is working constantly round the clock. So let's look at the pieces of the kidney. So we've got the cortex versus the medulla. We know that when we learned about adrenal anatomy and physiology, that the adrenals also have a cortex and a medulla. So in the cortex, which is here, the outer part, we've got the renal corpuscle and we've got the renal tubules, okay? The proximal and the proximal convoluted tubule and the distal convoluted tubule. In the medulla, which is the inner part, we've got parts of the nephron loop and the collecting ducts. And in the capsule is the outer shell. It's a stiff outer shell and it just maintains the shape. And it also provides some degree of protection. So let's look at the nephrons in detail, okay? So we've got the overall picture. Let's just come in and look at how this is working. So the nephrons are the microscopic functional units. They'd have to be microscopic, right? Because there is a million of them. And they filter the blood to produce the urine. And a million, that's a lot. So yeah, they have to be microscopic. There's no way you're going to open the kidney and see this with the naked eye because it's impossible. So the nephron's made of two parts, the capsule and the tubule. So if you look at the nephron, that's this little square here, which is highlighting the nephron. And then inside of it, you've got a cortex and a medulla as well. So we've got a cortex and a medulla of the big kidney, and now we have a cortex and a medulla of each of the nephrons. And so inside of each of the nephrons are those tubules that we talked about, right? The proximal convoluted, the loop of Henle, the distal convoluted, etc. We've got that detailed description of it and picture of it. In the cortex, we've got these pieces, right? And we've got the capsules, and basically this is what it looks like. The collecting duct is down here. And then they're filtering it all back out into the bloodstream. This isn't showing the arteries. The part goes back into the bloodstream and part goes out here. So it's a pretty sophisticated mechanism. I think if one of us tried to design this ourselves, unless we were a really fancy engineer, we'd have a hard time doing it. That's the beauty and the magic of our body. So let's look at the corpuscle, the renal corpuscle. It's responsible for filtering the blood, and it's formed by the capillaries of the glomerulus and the glomerular capsule. So if you look at this picture here, you've got this little glomerulus in here, and this thing called the Bowman's capsule is the outside. You've got the proximal convoluted tubule coming into this little glomerulus, and then the arterial and the filtered blood from the glomerulus to the body. So it goes out this way, right? So this is what helps the blood to get back to where it's supposed to go. The blood comes in, goes back out. So the glomerulus is actually a bundled network of capillaries that filters the blood and helps make the urine. Filters out the ammonia. The ammonia is produced as a metabolic waste product. It's produced as a byproduct of sulfur metabolism and part of liver detoxing. Uric acid, right? We get a buildup of uric acid in people with gout, which means that that's not being filtered and eliminated, and it's going back into the circulation and building up in people's joints. Urea, which is the main constituents of urine, and creatine, okay? Just pulls those out as much as we don't need and sends it out. The capsule, which surrounds it, is a thin filter to separate the urine from the blood. Think of it as if you have a reverse osmosis unit, how that water is put in and it has all kinds of toxins in it, and it's filtered through this thin membrane and the bad stuff is left behind. It's similar to a reverse osmosis unit, the way the kidneys work. It's just much more sophisticated. There's the detail of the renal corpuscle, and this is the complexity of it. So we've got all the tubules, and we've got the arteries and veins and all these little capillaries. This is where all the exchange happens. So let's talk about the tubules, the renal tubules. They concentrate the urine and recover non-waste solutes. So the tubules are responsible for pulling water back out of the urine that's been produced. The initial stages of pulling things out pulls back some of the water and recovers some of the solutes that got in there that we might still need, like maybe some sodium, maybe some proteins, that sort of thing. Carries the urine from the glomerular capsule into the renal pelvis. The tubule cells absorb so much of the water that if we had just not done this reabsorption, we would all become dehydrated. So it holds back. And that holding back is controlled by electrolytes and hormones. And we'll look at some of those hormones in a bit. The collecting ducts, the urine from the collecting ducts combines in the renal pelvis and then flows out of the kidneys and into the ureters. And the ureters then carry it down to the bladder. So whenever you urinate, think about the complicated process that's occurred to help you to create that urine. And you'll notice, and you can ask your clients about what the color of their urine is. You can notice that sometimes when you've been drinking a lot of water, your urine is pretty clear. And if you're not, then it's darker. And the darker it is, the more solutes, the more toxins, the more electrolytes might be in there. So when you're drinking a lot, there's a very thin urine and you've drunk more than your body needs, so the body is not pulling it back in, it's allowing it to go. So let's look at the blood flow. So the blood that's entering the kidneys is actually both oxygenated and deoxygenated. We've got blood that comes from the vena cava, which is the deoxygenated blood. We've got blood that comes from the abdominal aorta. So it's approximately a third of all the blood leaving the heart goes through the kidneys to be filtered before passing out. So it's really intricate and interesting system. So now that we've talked about the kidney anatomy and physiology, and we pretty much understand how that happens in a nutshell, blood enters the kidneys, it goes through this series of nephrons and glomeruli, they filter out what's not needed, and they filter out, they put back in water, and the amount of water they put back in has a lot to do with some of the hormone control, aldosterone and antidiuretic hormone, but also has to do with the electrolytes. So if there's a lot of sodium, we're going to hold on to more water. If there's more of a balance, we're going to let go of more water. So it's reading all these things. It's really like this little computer that's reading the blood, knowing what it should be looking like, and pulling things out so it gets it as close to quote unquote perfect as possible. So the ureters are just a pair of tubules. They're about, you know, 10 to 12 inches long. That's going to vary depending on the person and their size. And they're parallel. They run parallel to the vertebrae. The way that the urine moves downward towards the bladder is via the peristaltic movement of the smooth muscle tissue in there, and also gravity just pulls it down. Once the urine has reached the bladder, there's these little valves that don't allow the urine to backflow, because that would be pretty awful. The bladder is this muscular sac. It sits behind the pubic bone, and we can pretty much feel it when it's full. And it's about the size of a pear when it's empty, but it can expand. It's one of the most elastic organs in the body. The only one I can think of that might be more elastic is the uterus, because it grows and holds this big baby. It collects and stores the urine. That's it. That's its function. And it allows urination to be infrequent and voluntary, because if we didn't have that bladder there, then the urine coming down through the ureters would just flow right out of the body, not make for life to be very pleasant. So we're going to look at the bladder in more detail when we look at what can go wrong, because there's a lot of things that can go wrong with the bladder and that might your people might be complaining about. So there's the ureters coming in, there's the muscle that contracts when the bladder is full, there's the what's called the detrusor muscle, there's the pelvic floor muscles that help, and that's why Kegel exercises are important, because as we age, we may lose some of that bladder control, and even though it's under voluntary control, like big jumping exercise and such like that, may cause us to relax that bladder and leak urine. And so that's why we use the Kegel exercises to support the bladder via these pelvic floor muscles. And then the pubic bones are right here. So you can see where it sits. And then right down here, it leads into the urethra to be expelled. So here's a little bit more detail on it. The ureters come in here. We've got the peritoneum up here. Then we've got this muscular surrounding it. There's one called the detrusor muscle. And then if you look inside of the bladder, we see where the ureters come in, these little holes right here. There's something called the trigone, which is a little triangular area, an open area that leads down into the bladder neck and then into the urethra down here. And again, this is a close-up of the different musculature that can be used to hold that bladder neck in place so it doesn't leak urine. So let's look at the urethra, which is the last in it, probably the most simple part. It's obviously different in males and females. It's just the tube that the urine passes through from the bladder to get outside. The flow is controlled by the internal and external urethra sphincter muscles. The internal sphincter muscles is made of smooth muscle and opens voluntarily when the bladder reaches a certain level of distension. So we usually have control, but if we let it go too long, have you ever had that happen where it just, you're running to the bathroom and it just, you almost don't make it, or you don't make it and there's some leakage? We can't push our bladders to hold more than they can. They will start to leak as a result. So that happens because the urethral muscle opens up involuntarily. And the opening of the internal sphincter results in the sensation of needing to urinate. So we've got the urethra that passes in males through the penis. It passes directly out in females. Let's take a look at how hormones interact with the urinary tract. There's a diagram over here, and I'm going to talk to you about what the hormones are that are controlling this. Then we're going to look at each of those hormones in detail. And I'm going to close up on the diagram here so you can kind of see better what stimulates all this. So at the top, there's these green boxes, and these are things that will stimulate this activity that creates action in the kidneys, either telling them to absorb more, absorb less, more water, less water, electrolytes, etc. So if the body detects a decrease in blood volume, that's going to stimulate a hormone in the heart to produce and then stimulate the posterior lobe of the pituitary to stimulate the production of ADH, which is antidiuretic hormone. Antidiuretic hormone will increase the permeability of the distal convoluted tubules and collecting tubules. So that way it increases the reabsorption of water, because we need more water because we've detected a decrease in blood volume. This also increases the blood volume and reduces the osmotic concentration of the urine, obviously, right? So it's going to increase the blood volume and decrease the electrolytes and all that are leaving. And then the blood returns to volume, it's normal, and then ends the stimulation of the heart receptors. And then again, if we again figure out that there's a decrease, this whole cycle happens again. Another thing that can stimulate this action is the increase in osmotic concentration. So the blood is too concentrated. Then that stimulates receptors in the hypothalamus, which stimulates the posterior pituitary. We know that the hypothalamus, if we recall from early on, that the hypothalamus and the pituitary, it's like the hypothalamus is the big chief and the pituitary is the slave driver that talks to the rest of the crew. It's kind of like the hypothalamus is the CEO and the pituitary is the COO, which gets the chiefs to do it. Hypothalamus comes up with the ideas like, oh, we got to do this, and tells the pituitary to go get the crews to do it. That increases the ADH level. It increases the permeability of the distal tubules, increases the blood volume, and then it returns osmotic concentration to normal, and it ends the stimulation of the hypothalamus. So there's just a couple of routes that we get to this same stimulation of antidiuretic hormone. So I just thought this was a good picture for you to see overall what's happening. So let's look at how each of these hormones controls the function of the urinary tract, of the kidneys, basically. So we have calcitriol, which is the active form of vitamin D. We have estrogen, progesterone, obviously produced in the adrenals and also in the sex glands. We've got adrenaline and aldosterone that are produced in the adrenals. We've got renin, which is produced in the kidney. We've got atrial natriuretic peptide, which is produced in the heart. We've got antidiuretic hormone, ADH, that we just talked about. It's in the pituitary. And then erythropoietin, EPO, which is made in the kidneys. And we'll talk about each of these in turn and how they affect kidney function. So calcitriol, the active form of vitamin D, it's produced by the kidneys from the precursors produced by UV radiation. So we either take in a vitamin D, we have UV radiation, which creates the vitamin D. The kidneys have to activate it. They have to turn it into the active form, which is calcitriol. Works together with the parathyroid glands. The parathyroid glands that live in the neck, there's four of them. They're close to the thyroid, and that helps to raise the level of calcium in the bloodstream. Promotes the small intestines to absorb calcium from food and deposit it into the bloodstream. And sufficient calcium is important for kidney function. So basically, the way calcitriol gets involved, the active form of vitamin D, is to maintain the calcium function, the calcium levels, and that's super important for the functioning part of the kidney. How does estrogen influence the urinary tract? Well, there are receptors that have been observed in the urethra, the bladder, and the pelvic floor musculature, which is why we see when the estrogen levels go down, as in menopause, that there's some changes to the lining of the urethra and bladder. And women a lot of times experience increased frequency, increased urgency, nocturia, so waking up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, incontinence, and mainly it's stress incontinence, right? So it's, you can't jump and run and do exercise because those muscles are not holding the urine in place. And then a lot of times they experience recurrent infections in menopause. It's a weakening, it causes a weakening, or a deficiency causes a weakening of the group of muscles that support both the urethra and the bladder. So estrogen is super important for maintaining the muscular strength. And this is why we'll get to this in the treatment areas, but sometimes topically applying estriol cream to the opening of the urethra can oftentimes help women who have this stress incontinence or menopause-induced incontinence. So how does progesterone influence the urinary tract? Well, again, we observe that there's progesterone receptors in the urethra, the bladder, the pelvic floor. And progesterone plays several roles in preventing urinary tract infection. Well, first of all, it primes the estrogen receptors. So when it primes the estrogen receptors, we're more likely, even if there's a smaller amount of estrogen, to be able to accept the estrogen and have that increased musculature we just talked about. It opposes adrenaline. And adrenaline can trigger contractions in the bladder muscle and lead to pain associated with interstitial cystitis. And a lot of you have heard about interstitial cystitis, may have experienced it yourself or had patients or clients or family members with it. We're going to talk more about that in the pathology section. Aldosterone, good old aldosterone, which is produced in the adrenal cortex when the blood sodium levels are low. It causes a distal convoluted tubule to absorb more sodium and potassium back in. This happens when people are under a lot of adrenal stress and then they go into hypoadrenal function. And that's why a lot of times when people are in that state, you'll find your people who are adrenally exhausted saying they crave salt. And it's not a bad thing to give them the salt, as long as it's done in a healthy way with healthy, unrefined whole complex sea salt, you know, natural stuff, and to help to maintain this balance. Aldosterone causes the distal convoluted tubule to absorb more calcium and potassium. So it's a signal that, hey, the blood sodium levels are low. Let's go ahead and do this. Water is absorbed, which then increases the amount of water in the blood, and the high volume of water can increase blood pressure. One of the mechanisms by which the herb licorice works by causing that increased volume of water by in the system, it works similarly to aldosterone. And so we don't want to end up getting the blood pressure up by too much of that. So there's a lot of ways to circumvent it. And we'll talk about that in our protocols section. So atrial natriuretic peptide, it's a mouthful to say. It's produced by cardiac muscle cells in the walls of the atria. It's released in response to high volumes of blood. So the heart muscle is detecting, wow, the blood, there's a lot of blood here. We need to do something about it. And what it does is it stimulates this atrial natriuretic peptide, which works inside the kidney tubules to inhibit sodium absorption and decrease the amount of water that's absorbed back into the blood. Pretty important, eh? So let's talk about antidiuretic hormone, which is secreted by the pituitary gland. It controls the amount of water that's excreted by the kidney, and it also controls the concentration of the urine, how dilute or concentrated it is. It's secreted when the concentration of the solutes in the blood is too high. So there's too much concentration in the blood, and it allows the water to be absorbed at a higher rate to dilute the bloodstream in those collecting ducts, and then it opens more channels for the water to diffuse. Let's talk about erythropoietin, EPO. It's produced by the kidneys to stimulate the production of red blood cells. So you can see how everything is so interrelated. When the blood becomes hypoxic, meaning low oxygen, the cells lining the capillaries begin to produce EPO. EPO travels through the blood to the bone marrow and stimulates hematopoiesis. And they increase the rate of blood cell production in the marrow. So this is pretty important here. So the kidneys have something to do with the rate of blood cell production. Who knew that if you hadn't studied this before? So the way it works is the kidney detects hypoxia, low oxygen, or low red blood cells. It increases EPO, which then stimulates the bone marrow to produce more red blood cells. Now, we all know, based on previous studies, that in the marrow, when we're producing red blood cells, that those blood cells are produced in an immature state and then they need to mature. And so lack of B12 and folate in this area can really impact how well that is returned to normal. So if we're low in B12 and folate, we may not get that return to normal because of the lack of folate, which is needed to mature those red blood cells. So let's move on and talk about renin. Renin is an enzyme that kidneys produce to start the renin-angiotensin system. that renin-angiotensin system, also abbreviated as RAS, increases the blood volume and the blood pressure in response to low blood pressure, blood loss, or dehydration. And it causes the conversion in the liver from angiotensin to angiotensin 1. And we can see this if we zoom in on this picture, that we've got the liver, which is producing the angiotensin. It gets converted to angiotensin 1, which goes into the lungs and stimulates this conversion to angiotensin 2, which goes to the adrenals, which stimulates the production of aldosterone, which goes to the heart and down to the arteries and causes vasoconstriction, which can increase the blood pressure. When we produce the aldosterone, it causes the kidneys to increase more sodium. So we can end up with increased blood pressure as a result of a dysfunction in this area. Now, there are some genetic markers that some people are much more prone to this problem, but renin's a super important one. It's not technically a hormone, but I included it with the hormones because it's an enzyme produced that starts a catalyst of reactions in the body. And that's kind of what hormones generally do. So I wanted to include it here for completeness. So angiotensin 2 stimulates the adrenal cortex to produce aldosterone, which causes the kidneys to increase the reabsorption of water and sodium, increases the blood volume, raises the blood pressure. So the negative feedback from increased blood pressure turns off the renin-angiotensin system to maintain healthy blood pressure. So sometimes this goes wrong, and that's where a lot of people have hypertension. It's really a matter of looking to see what's causing their hypertension and working with them to get it improved. So here's a close-up. I'll review it again. We've got the kidney, which produces renin. The renin stimulates the liver to produce angiotensin and then convert it to angiotensin 1. Then the angiotensin 1 stimulates in the liver the angiotensin converting enzyme to produce angiotensin 2, which stimulates the adrenals to produce aldosterone, which stimulates the kidney again to increase sodium and water retention and increase the blood pressure. Aldosterone also stimulates the arteries and it causes vasoconstriction there, which increases the blood pressure. But with aldosterone, it's kind of like the Goldilocks principle. You don't want to have too much. You don't want to have too little. And what happens when the adrenals are hyperactive, like in a stage 1 adrenal dysfunction where people are in sympathetic mode all the time, then we end up with too much aldosterone. And that can cause the blood pressure to go up. When we end up with the hypofunction of the adrenals, usually like a stage 3 adrenal dysfunction, we end up with too little aldosterone. And so then the blood pressure goes down and people have low blood pressure or postural hypotension. And they also crave salt because they're trying to get their blood pressure up. They're trying to restore the balance here. And oftentimes we jump in and we want to give them some licorice and we got to be careful about overproducing it because it can produce this system and increase the blood pressure. So we want just the right amount of aldosterone. So let's review this one more time, how this works, how the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system works. It starts with there's low blood volume. The low blood volume stimulates the kidney to produce renin. Renin then stimulates the liver to produce angiotensin, convert it to angiotensin 1. It goes to the lung, which converts it to angiotensin 2. And let's look at all of the activities that happen as a result of angiotensin 2. Well, it increases sympathetic activity, so it stimulates the adrenals. It increases the tubular sodium chloride reabsorption and the potassium excretion and water retention, right? Because we have low volume that we're looking at here. And then it stimulates the adrenals to produce aldosterone, which also increases the retention. Then it stimulates the arteries to vasoconstrict, so increases the blood pressure. And it stimulates the pituitary gland to secrete ADH, antidiuretic hormone, which impacts the collecting ducts and the reabsorption of sodium and water. So it's helping us to increase the blood pressure. So it's a life-saving system, but it's when it goes awry that people have problems with blood pressure. When this is overstimulating, the blood pressure gets too high. It's supposed to turn itself off when the blood pressure gets back to normal. But there's a lot of things that increase blood pressure. that one of the kinds of drugs that people are given are ACE inhibitors over here. It inhibits the conversion from angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. So there's all kinds of ways to intervene, and we'll talk more about that when we get to the protocol section. So let's close with looking at the impact of poor performance by the bladder and kidneys. What does it present like? And we'll go into way more detail on this in the pathology section, and then what to do about it in the section on protocols. Kidney and bladder pain. So we're going to get pelvic pain or back pain, fatigue and weakness, nausea and vomiting, sleep problems, decreased mental sharpness, loss of appetite, frequent urination or scanty urination or incontinence or strong sudden urge to urinate. All of these can present as a result of the kidneys not filtering right, creating more toxicity in the blood, which is leading to this various symptoms like nausea, vomiting, mental fatigue, and overall fatigue, and then urinary symptoms. So it's not just presenting as urinary symptoms, which is what I wanted to get across to you. So that's it for the introduction to the anatomy and physiology of the urinary tract system. We'll see you on the next video.